Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello everyone, welcome along to The Ruck, the rugby podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Alfie Reynolds and I've got Will Kelleher to my right, Alex Lowe to my left, but Will is sat on what looks like a bench in a rugby dressing room.
We're on tour, Alfie.
On location, pre-Christmas, but for the episode on Boxing Day. So I hope you've had all a great Christmas as you're listening to this, because we have been invited up, out of London, up to the north, and Sale Sharks are hosting us today, Alex.
Day behind the scenes at Sale Sharks.
Very windy. It's very windy. So we're recording this before they play Saracens on the Friday before Christmas, and they're expecting 45-mile-an-hour winds.
But also sell-out crowd, which we'll awesome. Come to, I'm sure, which rather indicates the growth that's happened at this club in the last couple of years, really. They've played before one man and a dog at times. It's felt in the stadium here in Salford, but they had sell-out crowds in the playoffs last year. They've had big crowds this season and another bumper crowd against Saracens in a repeat of the final. So we're here really to sort of tell the story of the re-emergence of Sale Sharks as a Premiership powerhouse.
Made the final last year. They're hoping to get back there. It's going to be interesting to see that kind of psychological thing. I know Exeter have talked about it in the past, of getting to the big dance and sort of being happy to be there. I wonder how Sale are thinking about it also. It's going to be interesting. They've got some good England players as well. We might have a chat too as well.
Yeah, so coming up on the podcast, I'm looking forward to it, because I know we've spoken about them so far this season, and it just feels like a club that is building something and a real identity to it as well, which we'll get into throughout this podcast. So coming up, we're going to chat to the co-owner Michelle Orange. We're going to be speaking to Alex Sanderson as well, some of the more experienced senior heads in the dressing room in George Ford and Manu Tuilagi.
What a cast list.
It is good, and it gets even better,
does it,
because some of the younger guys as well who are coming into the team and seriously stamping their mark on this team and the Premiership as well, in Tom Roebuck and Joe Carpenter.
Possible future internationals. But for which country?
Well, we shall wait and see.
Stay
so,
tuned.
Merry Christmas to you all. This is a little festive, a little post-Christmas present for you after the big day. So, first up, coming up, it will be the Sale Sharks co-owner, Michelle Orange. Michelle Orange, how are you?
Hi, really well. Thank you so much for coming. It's lovely to see you all here.
Well, I was going to say thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure. Anyone who's willing to travel north of the M25, we're really welcome to have you, anyone.
The first thing I wanted to ask was, as a co-owner of a Premiership club, and obviously the women's team and everything that entails, there's been a lot of negativity over the last 18 months. Like, what's it like owning a Premiership club? What's the landscape like? How difficult is it?
Yeah, it's pretty tough. The highs and lows. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Simon, Jed and I have actually only been in the business of running a rugby club for, I think we're on season 8 now. So we had a very steep learning curve, a lot to learn. I think a lot that we didn't realise we'd be taking on. But I think the nice thing is that we've grown into that role organically. We didn't necessarily have any tutors, and there aren't any certainly any instruction manuals to read. We've benefited tremendously from the advice of the other owners of the other clubs. Your likes of Nigel Melville, who's very instrumental as a mentor, really, for the owners of the clubs. And then, obviously, with the relationship we have with Prem Rugby, Simon Massey-Taylor, all his amazing crew, and, you know, with the RFU.
Can you tell us your story? Because you're a proper Sale fan, aren't you?
That's why
you got into
it.
Yeah. So you would go down to Hayward Road and all that in the noughties and things like that?
Yeah, slightly earlier than that. I was born in Bredensale. Literally grew up about half a mile from Hayward Road, the ancestral home. And I remember, I mean, my dad always, I mean, in those days, I was born in the 70s, so there was very little live football on. The only live football you'd got on television would be FA Cup, and then obviously it would be Match of the Day. So as a little girl, didn't really ever get to see Match of the Day. And my dad was always interested in rugby, so we used to watch the Five Nations, because it was still the Five Nations, in black and white. And I always used to be intrigued when you'd get the football results up, you know, final score, and video printer, and Sale would come up, because obviously we were really successful. We've always been a really good, high-performing rugby team, so I was always fascinated by that, you know, we had Manchester United, we're on the right side of town, so we've been United fans. And then Sale. So it kind of grew from there, and then went to school in Sale, went to Sale Girls Grammar, which is literally a stone's throw from Hayward Road. Mm. We were a girls-only grammar school. The only way to see the boys was to basically meet at Hayward Road at the weekend. Right. So that's where we'd go. And then a lot of our growing up was going to, you know, a lot of the lads played rugby. Of course, it wasn't even available to the concept for women to be, girls to be playing rugby in those days. But a lot of our school discos and stuff like that, they'd all been rugby clubs because the lads all played rugby. So it's just always been there.
So how did you get to the point where you own it? Well, it was your decision, was it, to convince
not.
Simon?
I actually worked for Sale. So the year that the sport went professional, the premiership was set up, I actually did a whole season working at Sale. I kind of had a few jobs, but ultimately ended up like doing all the sort of community-based marketing. And then we continued to be supporters. We weren't necessarily season ticket holders. We obviously followed them. I mean, I'm ashamed to say we didn't go to Twickenham 2006 when they were on the... I know, it's terrible, isn't it? Then we moved to New York in 2009. We've always known Steve Diamond, long-time friend, and he happened to be in America with the Russian team, which was coaching at the time. Yeah. I think he was aware that Brian Kennedy, the then incumbent owner, was possibly getting a bit of investor fatigue. He was obviously very worried about the future of the club, and I suppose eventually groomed us into thinking it'd be a really clever idea to take it over. I was 100% against it, because we had a really busy life, quite a complex life, flitting to and from New York. Of course, I got my psychology wrong. What I should have said, genius, absolutely brilliant idea. Yeah, let's go buy a rugby team, about to hit the menopause, let's have a load of like really fit young men wandering around in shorts and training socks all that. That's really clever, but I didn't. I said, no, I don't want you to buy a rugby club. So I went the wrong way. That said, best thing we've ever done. Seriously, we've been together 34 years now. The amount of joy and pride it brings to us to be able to be so heavily involved and to help see the success of the club grow, not just on the pitch, but across the northwest, is immense.
You've said, I think, before that the club's now signed into your wills.
Yeah,
100%. So you're properly committed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're going to have to cart us out of here in wooden boxes when we go.
Let's
I'm
hope
expecting
not.
My ashes to be sprinkled on the pitch. Yeah, because, you know, it's obviously a difficult business. There are obviously financial sustainability issues at the moment. We're committed. We love the club. We love what we've enjoyed from owning the club for the last 8 seasons. We've got huge ambitions and aspirations with it. And the last thing we would ever want to see is if we were to die, and obviously, you know, we're all going to die at some point, but if we were to go, who's going to take it on? Simon and I don't have children, not of our own. We do have 80-odd players that I very much call myself Mummy Shark. So, yeah, we've put it in the will. We want to make sure we can sustain it for as long as possible.
And how big a responsibility do you feel to the... I know you've had the Northern Rugby Matters, to rugby in the Northwest?
Massively, because, you know, we've seen the struggles. Obviously, we're competing in an area where there's not only like the best rugby league in the country, but some of the best elite sport in the country, football, cricket, everything. So it's a tight market and it's tight to win that support. But we'd like to think we can generate that support, even if, you know, the people of the Northwest aren't necessarily coming to matches every week, that they're actually following us and, you know, they get a high when they see us reach the final, hopefully eventually lift the trophy. So it is really important. You know, I'm a very proud Northerner. I've lived here my entire life, apart from a few months in New York, a few years in New York. But, you know, my roots have never gone. And I am, you know, I'm proud, I'm competitive, and I would love to see the club really succeed and continue at the top flight for a very long time.
It's an interesting time to talk to you, because 8 years into your ownership, it feels like the Premiership is at a point where in the new year, if everything comes to fruition, there'll be a relaunch, if that's the right word, certainly a reset, a new deal with the RFU. Given the 18 months that we've just been through with the Premiership, How encouraged are you by what the future could hold for the league and therefore for the 10 clubs in it?
I'm very excited about the future. I mean, I wholly believe that it's such a great game. It's such a great sport. It's such a great ethos, the crowds that you get, the atmosphere you get. And I would just love for that word to be spread. You know, they can sell Twickenham three or four times over for every Six Nations match. That's, you're looking at 320,000, 400,000 people who are happy to buy a ticket to go to the Six Nations. Most of those people live in England. Why they're not coming to support their domestic clubs, because they don't seem to. A little anecdote, but during lockdown, I met our next door neighbour's sons. They kept kicking the football and then the rugby ball over the fence, and I was returning it, and obviously we were chatting over the fence, and I asked the little lad who he supported football wise and he was a United fan, and I said, oh, what about rugby? He goes, oh, I support England. I was like, oh, do you not have a team that you support? He goes, no, I just support England. I was like, did you know that there's like a Manchester United in the rugby world in the northwest? He was like, no. So anyhow, I think the next time I was here, obviously we had slightly more access privileges than a lot of the rest of the country, being able to come to games when play resumes. So I was able to go into the club shop and raid it and get pencil cases and T-shirts and balls for him and his brother. And he's now like a firm Sale Sharks fan and comes to games. So it is that, it's like, why do so few people actually, relatively speaking, comparatively speaking, to go to Six Nations? So there's that market that needs tapping in. And there's a whole masses of generations out there that hopefully will, you know, come on board and join us for the fun.
And do you know what the answer is? Because I dare say that the rugby community in the northwest isn't necessarily the same community that will go to Twickenham for those games.
No.
But there's an interest there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And if we knew, then we wouldn't necessarily be in the position we are as the clubs. Everyone tries really hard, and you can see how hard everyone's trying. You only need to sit in the owners' meetings or, you know, the joint commercial managers' meetings to see how every single club in the league is really, really trying hard to attract these new audiences. And it's a very tough market out there, and obviously it's a very tough economic climate for people, so it's a big ask to expect people to be able to come week in, week out to matches. But it's there, and I'm really disappointed. I don't know how many people watched the Mud, Sweat and Tears documentary that went out on Amazon Prime recently. I first watched Drive to Survive a couple of years ago when I was actually isolating with COVID, and I binge watched four series in about 3 days, and I was watching that and I was like, why on earth have we not got a Try to Survive? I mean, it would have been a very devastating time for clubs, but it would have been a fascinating time for clubs with, unfortunately, the, you know, the demise of Worcester and Wasps. But it really would have given you a landscape of how difficult it is. And even Welcome to Wrexham, when you watch that, yeah, all right, it's got two Hollywood stars with all their money behind it, but it's still difficult for them. It's still, you know, a task day in and day out. And I think if you can get people on board and they can get ingratiated with that, you can attract more people to come to the games. And unfortunately, the Amazon one apparently hasn't had enough viewers. I don't know for what reason, so they're not going to commission it. But I think if they were given the opportunity to properly go in and do a full season featuring all 10 clubs and also featuring like the workings with the RFU and the Prem Rugby to get the whole landscape of what's going on, I think people really would be engaged and they would come on board.
Is that somewhere maybe where the women's game can lead the way? Because it's a sort of younger sport and maybe understands that it needs to market itself so much more. And I know you're so involved with the women's here, Sale Sharks women, aren't you? Like, do you see that as the big growth area of this club, but also English rugby as well, with the World Cup coming in 18 months and all that?
I think it's definitely a way to engage more supporters, be it for both men's and women's rugby, or one or the other. Doing things like behind-the-scenes documentaries would be amazing. It's like almost free marketing. And because, I mean, obviously there are so many sports documentaries out there, but there aren't that many solely on women's sport. So I think it would be fascinating, as now we're having this organic growth of the PWR, the Premiership Women's Rugby. It would be brilliant to get something like that going. And it is very, very different. I mean, although our male rugby players are paid well, they're not paid anything like a male professional footballer is, for example, in the higher leagues. But the women really aren't. You know, they're paid a pittance, in all honesty, because we're trying to, again, make it sustainable and slowly grow the wage bills, because otherwise it's just going to implode. But I think that sort of background, that landscape, would be really interesting for people to come and film.
How are you finding the Premiership Women's Rugby stuff? Because initially Sale didn't get in, you didn't win the bid, I suppose, but then have now got in.
Yeah.
You're the only Northern club, really,
yeah.
Proper Northern club.
Yeah.
Beat Harlequins in November.
We did.
Which is an amazing result,
yeah.
Having basically not had a team, really.
Yeah.
So how's that? Seems like it's growing really fast.
It has been. I mean, as I said, you know, earlier, you know, we only bought the club in 2016. We had no knowledge of running a rugby business. We had a men's team, and a men's team that was performing reasonably well and had reasonable support, but wasn't brilliant. So it took us time, you know, to get to grips with that. And not long after getting involved in the club, quite a few girls who work in our South Sharks Foundation, the community section of the club, who were all rugby players, were like, can we have a rugby team? You know, they knew that the RFU were asking for tender places for not this PWR, but for the previous, the Allianz Premier 15s. And I just thought, well, yeah, we need to get on this now. If we miss the boat now, it'll take us some time to swim out and catch it up. So we did it during very difficult times. In COVID, I mean, we actually did our presentation to the RFU the second day of lockdown. Wow. We all had to learn how to do Zoom.
So, like, what? That's what, April.
That was March 2020. Yeah. And then when we got the nod, we had to recruit online. We had to get girls to send show reels. We couldn't actually do trials. When they came into training, which was August, September that year, we could only train in cohorts of six. It was all one way. You know, masks, one-way testing, one-way systems at the training ground. So it has been like a real struggle. I think now this season we're confident we've got the right coaching team together. We've got Rachel Taylor, Casey Jane McLean leading the helm with some other amazing coaches, S&C, physios, etc., etc. And we've got a really good, strong group of girls. And I think this will be the start of us getting there.
Are there some parallels between where the women's team is now and where the men's team was when you took over in terms of how you're having to approach it? At that time, that was before, you know, Manu Tuilagi and George Fort. You couldn't necessarily sign the kind of England players, which is maybe where you kind of are with the women's team at the moment.
We're exactly going through. It's like, it's unbelievable. It's mirror-like. So, yeah, when we took over the men's team, as I say, we were performing well. We were finishing 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th. You know, Sale is one of the only teams never, ever to have been relegated from the Premiership. So that's obviously something we've always wanted to maintain. But we couldn't attract England stars to come and play for us. We weren't sexy. We weren't necessarily performing.
And they'd have to move.
They'd have
200
to move
miles
up north,
or something, maybe,
obviously.
Yeah.
So it full credit to Steve Diamond and, you know, the analysts and the recruitment team. We went out shopping in South Africa. We realised there was a market there to tap. You know, we got Faf de Klerk. So who, you know, admittedly at the time wasn't performing particularly well himself. His international career was faltering. And it was almost like a perfect yin and yang for us. He came in, he was amazing. He really put us on the map just because of who he was and the whole golden unicorn. But also, likewise, he's lent his experience, brought his mentoring values to the pitch. And that's why we've now got Rafi Quirk, Gus Waugh, Nye Thomas, all coming through the ranks, who are all benefiting massively from the influence of Faf de Klerk. And that's just one of them. We've got three Duprees, we had Johnny Ross, we had Van Rensburg. But the ratio of international foreign players, so South Africans compared to the homegrown young lads, is reducing. And what it has enabled us to build that really strong team of northern homegrown lads. We've had the same problem with the women. We've not been able to recruit England Roses to come and play. A quarter at least of the current England team actually originate from the north, but have ended up playing their club rugby in other parts of the country, which is highly understandable. One, we didn't have a particularly successful team in the northwest, so they're not going to want to come back and play for us and affect, you know, their performance, their ability to get selected for England. Completely understand that. But then they're all clustering together. I mean, you look at Bristol, they've got the front five of the England team, which is great, but we're not going to be able to penetrate that. So we've had to go roughly down the same road we did with the men. We've gone overseas. We've got some amazing Americans. We've got we've actually got Amber Schurner now, Nick Schurner's sister-in-law. We've got the two amazing Italians, Tinesi and Rigoni, coming. So like Rigoni is like almost our Faf de Klerk on the women's team. She is that sort of legendary person. And that, again, is it not only just helps performance on the pitch, but it raises awareness off the pitch. It's getting us into trouble with PWR and RFU because they obviously have EQP regs, which is English Qualified Players, which, again, is the most sensible practice in place in that, of course, you want to have as many EQP players on your squad because we, collectively as a league, are trying to develop the best England talent as we can for the benefit of the national team. But we've got, like, in our under-20 section, some amazing, amazing girls, but they're going to have mentors on the pitch, not just on the pitch, but also in the training ground to bring them along. And without that international experience, it's a much, much harder and longer process. So that's why we've done it. It's not particularly popular. we may actually have points deducted this season if we don't meet our EQP. But I'm going to stand firm and resolute and say, look, we've done it with the men. When we went to Twickenham with the boys in May, we had 13, 14 who were homegrown lads that we've developed, we've nurtured them. So just give us a chance and we prove to ourselves in a couple of seasons we can get there, but it doesn't happen overnight.
Build it and they'll come. The classic phrase, isn't it?
Exactly.
Michelle, thank you so much.
You're so very welcome. Sorry for waffling.
No, good, not perfect. At all. We really appreciate it and thanks for having us up.
No, you're very welcome and Merry Christmas.
George Ford, Manu Tuilagi. Good to see you, boys. How are you both?
Yeah, great. Thank you. It's good to be here, chatting to you guys. But yeah, all good. Obviously, in the midst of our Premiership season, and we've got a big game to look forward to, obviously, this week. But yeah, all good. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll get on to the season so far and the 2023 in just a moment. Manu, how are you? How's that hand? Strapped a little bit?
Yeah, all good. Thank you. It is better than it looks. It doesn't look great, but it's all right. It's all good. Like Ford is saying, we'll look forward to the game on the weekend.
Manu, our listeners can't see this, but I can. You've got quite a big scar across your middle knuckle on your right hand. Can you talk us through what happened? Was that in the Samoa game at the World Cup that happened?
Yeah, I did it in the Samoa game and then did it properly against Argentina. Just got a plate.
Which
in
Argentina?
There.
The playoff game or the group
no,
match?
No, the last game.
Yeah, okay. The bronze match.
Yeah, so it's all good. It's what it is, isn't it?
Doesn't look the best, though. Is it all right? Are you all right with it?
But it doesn't
Do you have to have it fully
it looks
strapped?
The best, is it? As long as it feels good, it does. It feels good.
So you've been up this way, almost 3 years now?
Nearly four. Yeah.
So can you, George is obviously from this neck of the woods, but can you talk to us about your kind of northwest life, Manchester life, how you're loving it up here?
I love it since the first day I came. I love it. And the people up here, they're so nice and friendly. So I've been enjoying it. I'm enjoying it here at Sale Sharks. What we're trying to build here, and Al and Si and Jed and everyone trying to build an environment that you want to come in every morning, you want to wake up and looking forward to get in and see the boys and play some good rugby.
It's interesting you say there, Manu, about you mentioned the owners and it feels like something is being built. It's something we've spoken about on the podcast this year, that from an external perspective, it feels like there's something building. Does it really feel like for you guys, even as players, when you're so focused on, say, the week in, week out match results, that there's something bigger being built?
100%. I think the rugby is the easy part. It's try and get everyone together, the players. I mean, everyone, you come from all different backgrounds. I think the tough goal is try and get everyone on the same page, going in the same direction. I think that's why I take my hat off to any coaches, man. It's not an easy job. I think the rugby side of it, I think it's a lot easier for them than their life coaches as well at the same time.
George, the van outside the stadium's got Fabric of the North written on it. On our way here, we were talking to the taxi driver about when Sale played at Stockport County and that stadium was full and they had a winning team. You came back here for a reason, to tap back into that, your roots, I guess, but does it feel that the club, with a success on the field, 10,000 sell-out for the Saracens game, are beginning to recapture those days again?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. I remember going to Edgeley Park, watching Sale when I was a kid, and some of the atmospheres there with the great team they had with Jason Robinsons and Sebastian Chabals and people like that, it was a big thing. Sale Sharks was a big thing in the north, and we're definitely getting back to, or if not, we're back there already, in my opinion, with some of the atmospheres we're getting here, the amount of people who wanted to come and watch us. Yeah, and hopefully inspiring sort of people who play rugby in the north, especially the next up and coming boys and girls who have dreams to play for the local club, Sale Sharks, and hopefully bigger things beyond that. Like, our job is to be good role models, to inspire them and hopefully give them some entertaining rugby to watch, because obviously you need to play well and win to make people come and watch you, and I think we're getting somewhere near that now, yeah.
Well, we got you, our kid, then.
Yeah. You got that in terms of the squad, though, as well. We're going to speak to, I think, some of the younger guys later who are coming through, but there's quite a lot of them in the squad now. Again, you look at your squad, you've got you guys as experienced internationals, but then Gus War, Joe Carpenter, Aaron Reid, Tom Roebuck, a real identity of young northern guys coming into the team.
Yeah, definitely. I was taken back a little bit by it, to be honest, when I first came to the club. Obviously, the club's in the north, it's in and around Manchester, but how many northern lads were part of the squad? especially the young lads coming through, but there's obviously been lads who've been here for years as well, like the Josh Beaumonts, Tommy Taylors, Ross Harrisons, of them lads who grew up around the area. Then you've got this next group coming through with Reedy, Roebuck, Carps, Gus, Tom Curtis, and it's like a bit of a conveyor belt, really. There's another group under them as well who are all coming through, and I think it's brilliant. Like, the catchment area obviously is big enough with the rugby schools and the local community clubs, but yeah, I mean, for them guys to have a dream to play for Sale, who were a successful club, hopefully at the top of the Premiership, is what it's all about, really.
Manu, after the first Argentina game at the World Cup, you referred to George as our kid. I wonder, after 4 years here, are you really picking up the Manchester lingo?
Nah, me and our kid go way back. Way back in the academy days, isn't it? Yeah. And obviously the Midlands, 16s, 18s. So yeah, we know each other for a long time. I'm basically a northerner now.
Are you? Is that how you feel?
100%.
Is that how you speak?
Yeah. Well, it has changed a bit when I go back to Leicester. They're like, what's wrong with you? Like, why is your accent like that?
It is funny, obviously, because we came in through the academy at Leicester, and we played for many years at Leicester in England. And then when I was sort of making my mind up or decision where to come, like, the first person who rang me was man who was like, man, I love it up here, up north. And couldn't speak highly enough of it, and yeah. I was like, right, if Manu loves it, it must be a good place to be. So
I remember that kid. Yeah. I remember being said, he's like, oh mate, we're trying to sign you, mate. I was like, who's that? He's like, oh yeah, give him a call for us. But yeah, that's exactly what I said to Fordy. Like, I said to him, like, look, I'm not a salesman. I don't know how to sell nothing, but this is how I feel about the club. Unbelievable.
So, George, it's your turn to ring him now, is it? Because what, contract out in the summer? Big decisions to make? You're trying to convince him to stay for 4 more years or whatever?
Yeah, I don't know if he needs any convincing, because, honestly, I see how happy he is. And you can see that by the way he's playing on the field. Like, it's obviously getting the best out of Manu. It seems to be, as he's getting older and drinking more red wine, Manu, maybe.
It's good for the heart, they say.
That he's, like, his performances on the field and training day to day is probably the best that I've seen playing with him. So obviously everyone's situation is different, but I know for a fact he loves it here, and hopefully things get sorted there.
Yes, okay.
In your own words, Manu, like, where are you at with your career now? You're 32, and I remember in the 2019 World Cup you said that would probably be your last one. Then obviously you make it to 23 World Cup. Where are you sitting now with the future and where you want to be and all that?
For me at the moment, I'm enjoying it. I don't really look too far ahead. Like, I wake up and I'm like, right, let's enjoy this session today, whatever it may be. And, you know, like my contract, I don't even know what's going on. So for me, sometimes, you know, when you think we're too far ahead, you miss what's now. So I don't want to miss that. I love it. I love it here, like the boys at the club and everyone around. So we just try and give as much as possible for everyone at the club.
I was thinking, if you don't mind me looking too far ahead, the Tuolangi clan's expanding, isn't it? You've got Posolo now.
Yeah.
You might play against him. French under-20s could get a spot in the French squad. That'd be pretty cool.
I know. I hope so. I hope so.
He's your nephew, right?
Yeah, he's Henry's Henry's son, my brother Henry's son. I hope he progressed with his rugby, and I hope he does well. Because for me, firstly, he's a really good lad. It's important, and he's a good player. And his dad is so old school, man. Like, he'll make sure his feet stay on the ground. That was
you met him, didn't you, Will?
Yeah, I did. So we went to some top 14 awards, and he was up for one of the breakthrough players of the year, and he was there in his traditional Samoan gear and stuff like that, loving it. And I think you're saying Henry's keeping his feet on the ground, but he was taking people off their feet most of his career, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, some seriously big hits.
Yeah, it's lucky that his dad's there, his family's there. I mean, you know, for a young lad to break through, you need that guidance, and his dad's been there. And I always say to Henry, hey, just, it's good, but not too much.
Yeah. Is one of the other reasons why you're loving it here, like, we know how much you've struggled with injuries and stuff all over your career, but you've been managed really well here, it seems, and the good relationship with Al and the coaching staff here, and they've sort of, I don't know, married it up between England a bit more with how they manage your workload and stuff like that. Has that helped prolong your career a bit longer, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. The guys here, they've been amazing, like you say, managing my meters week in, week out. You know, they have the live GPS on the field, so if it's up there, then we cut it. If it's not, then you need to get up there. So it's a fine balance of, you know, not doing too much, but also undercooked. So these guys have been really good, Al and Nav and Kirk in S&C and the physio. So and they are working together as well with England to try and find the sweet spot, which is awesome.
George, can you also, like, you guys have had that relationship for so long, just explain how transformative Mano can be on the field? Like, I think when you first came here, when you were injured, you were talking to guys about putting him in spaces, not of faces and stuff like that. Like, you've played with him for so long. Like, how different does he make the game plan for you?
Well, I don't think there's anyone else like him in the world. I'm not just saying that either, but in terms of, like, what he brings to us as
making
a team.
Making it blush now.
No, yeah. What he brings to us as a team, well, first and foremost, like, physically, energy-wise, is enormous, and he shows that through his actions. And, like, I'm sure you won't mind me saying, but, like, in terms of, like, leadership in other areas and, like, bringing other lads with us as well, he's definitely stepped up as well in terms of that. But, yeah, like, what we try and do, ultimately, is try and put him in positions where he can be most dangerous or lethal with the ball. And it's not, like, necessarily asking him to run through brick walls, but it's like getting one-on-ones. It's like trying to get him the ball more in unstructured play, in phase play, where he can take people on, because good luck to whoever tries to tackle him in terms of that. And then he's obviously one of our defensive leaders. Like, the way he gets off the line and sets the tone with his collisions, it has a bit of a deeper message, right? It just brings everybody with us, and you need them people in your team to sometimes not lead through the voice, but just say, right, lads, I'm going. I'll show you how to do it. Come with us, sort of thing. And he's probably that guy.
Has Alex given you the Malbec? He said he'd give you a bottle of red wine if you matched George's energy. He hasn't yet, has he?
He's not. I think he drank it. I think I said to him, well, that's the best thing to do about wine is to drink it. So I'm all right. I don't mind.
What is your favourite red?
It's Malbec. But actually, over the World Cup, my brother, they came every weekend and he'd bring like 3-4 boxes of wine from, because he does catering.
Okay, so he's got his own gin as well, doesn't he?
No, that's my other brother.
Okay, right.
But there's this winery, it's called Lafarge, the main Lafarge in Perpignan, and he works together, so he gets a lot of boxes of wine. So he brought them up, and this bottle is called Narasa. Oh my God. Delicious.
What I love, man, is you cause terror out on the field, but off the field your hobbies are the most sort of sedate, calm ways of, like, snooker, chess, glass of red, make a coffee. It's like chalk and cheese. What you like off the field is what you like on the field.
Just chill. Just like to chill, and with a chess, it's nice to keep the mind a bit going as well, because I've got 3 kids now and they're absolutely mental. So I need a bit of time to relax. Yeah,
headspace.
A bit of downtime. Boys, yeah. We really appreciate your time. And just final one from me, really. We're coming to the end of 2023, a year where Sale got themselves back to the Premiership final for an hour of that game, right in it, and then end up losing. Great start to the new campaign as well. Where do you feel that the club are in terms of on the pitch, how you're playing as we head into 2024?
Yeah, I think we're growing. I think we've come a long way, don't get me wrong, but we don't necessarily try and look too far behind us. We try and look ahead and how to improve. And ultimately, we throw everything into our preparation in terms of that. So, look, we know that, especially the way the Premiership is and the way Europe is, that if you're not quite on it in terms of your preparation, then you don't give yourself best chance to come play well at weekend. So we're very much trying to stay in the air and now and look forward. But, we've got a group here who are hungry and got great desire to get better, from the players to the coaching staff to the owners at the top as well. So we'll just keep going in that direction, hopefully.
Awesome. Thanks for your time, boys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So up next, it's like a revolving door on this stage of where we are. One leaves, another enters. Alex Sanderson, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for showing a bit of interest. Always appreciate it.
Oh, well, I think it's good to be here. Sale, a club that there should be a lot of interest in over the last couple of years, the way that you've started the season.
Yeah.
Speaking to the players, the co-owner, feels like something is being built at the club. I suppose for you that's been over, how many years has it been now since you came up here?
3 years, almost to the day. It was kind of in the start of the new year when I joined, mid-season, and just by a matter of semantics, built or building. Like, I still feel like we're building.
Yeah.
No, and that's really important, because when you're building, it feels fresh, it feels exciting. There's that old expression, I think it was a guy that ran McDonald's, not Ronald McDonald, not the clown. He said, you're either green and growing, or ripening and rotting. Like, there's nowhere in between. So if you built it, you're probably rotting. You know, we are definitely green and growing at the moment, which is exciting.
And how big a responsibility do you feel to drive that every day, constantly building, constantly getting better?
Yeah, it's the challenge. That's the never-ending, constantly shifting, because we're talking about people here. It's not just a business model that you can set the wheels in motion to, and, you know, you invest this much and you get that much profit. Like, It's a day-to-day feel of what the team needs, what my mates need, what the staff need. And I have my part in that. Like, I'm obviously, win and loss kind of comes down to me ultimately, and I'm happy to share that responsibility. But I'm very lucky for, if I'm not having a great day, you know, mood-wise or whatever, I can lean into people that will pick me up. And that's how it should be. You should be able to take me out as a wheel, and maybe a bigger wheel than most, or a cog in the machine, and the machine still run. That's, I think, the truer test of how strong your environment is.
How's, on that note, related, I suppose, the psychological challenge of being from going to the final and then trying to do it all again? I remember Rob Baxter talking about that with his Exeter team in, I think, 2016, when they made their first final. And when he got into the next season, he thought, we were happy to be there at Twickenham. There were lots of lads who, that was their first game at Twickenham, we were a young team, and we weren't there to win it, we were there to take part in it. Whereas the next season, they were like, we're going to go and win this now. So how's that been for your squad and your guys, trying to come and do it again?
My worry was that when you experience true failure, and I've said this before, like, true failure requires you to put everything of yourself out there. And when you don't win, when it doesn't work out for you, it hurts so much that some part of you, even subconsciously, holds a bit back, you know, because it does hurt that much. That's true failure. I think we went there. I think we put everything out there in the final. So we addressed it in Marbella with the lads. And I was like, look, I just wanted to know, like, how you're feeling for that reason. And they were like, no, got a taste of it. Like, want more type thing. Certainly, it hasn't persuaded them. It's only encouraged them, dissuaded them. It's encouraged them to go again and train harder and obviously evolve the game, which I feel like we've been doing.
True failure sounds a really harsh way of describing what to most people would seem like a huge step forward for this club to make the final. You're on the journey, you're green and growing, as you say, but do you have to look at it in those stark terms that you went to try and achieve something and didn't, so therefore it's only failure? Or
no, we fail every Tuesday. Like, seriously, like, we put them in positions where we take them to the extremes of their physical capabilities, and then we still make them fail. We'll still introduce a second ball or a scenario, a sin bin scenario, to try to see how they respond from failure. So I don't mean the season wasn't a failure by any stretch, but the day was. Mm. Coming back to, I guess, motivational drivers and the rest, if it is just down to one day, you live quite a shallow existence. There's 364 that went before it, of which we had a brilliant time and put ourselves out there as well. But on that day, I think we did what we could and came away second best. And you have to accept that and either carry it, gesticulate, it demotivate you, or accept it and say, right, we want to win this, we've got to be better, and I think that's what we're doing. I feel that's what we're doing.
Have you always had that perspective, Alex?
No.
Did you have to learn it, I suppose?
I had to fail a few times, yeah. We lost back-to-back games with a club whose name I shall not mention. Back-to-back finals, actually, Premiership and Europe. I've had to,
2014, that would have been, yeah.
Yeah, look, and, you know, the motivation post that was easier than when we went back-to-back wins, for the same reason that if it is just about a day, even though many people aspire to win a Premiership or a European, as we do, for the fortunate few that do, they realise that it can't come down to the fleeting moment that defines all the effort that you put in for the whole of your life. It can't do. It's just too short a moment to live and relive by way of justifying the sacrifices you make. So I've said this before, it has to be about the journey, it has to be about the players, the day-to-day enjoyment, and when you stop, when the fun stops, stop, you know.
And you're right up at the top of the league. There were sell-out for the Saracens game. Was there a point when your concern that you addressed in Marbella ceased being a concern, where perhaps the younger players, more than the more experienced lads who may have experienced that failure and understand how to bounce back, where the concern you addressed in Marbella ceased to be a concern because you knew that the kids and the younger players, they were showing with their actions how hungry they were to go again, and it's proven so because you're at the top of the league?
Yeah, from the start, I think the first few games you can see where we're at, because that's a reflection of how hard you've trained and how you've prepped in the pre-season. And you know, like everyone had numbers down. We started well, started strong, and were able to maintain that for the most part. Certainly in the manner of which we won games, which wasn't pretty at times, but just doggedly determined to find a way. And we've seen that more often than we've seen us on good form this season. And you get to this point, and we're in a good position, which we appreciate, and you know, we've worked hard to get there for. But you're so far away from the start of the season, and you're so far away from the end of the season, it can become a bit of a mucky patch. And this is where the challenge of re-energising, you know, believing that you're still developing your game, you're not just waiting on for people to lose games or to lose form, like you've got to try and keep growing so you can pull away, not just hang in there. And that's different mentality for us. We've always been chasing around this point in the season, so we are feeling and finding our way through that.
And can I just ask about the size of the crowds that you're now attracting to
bumper sellouts,
exactly, which is partly what you're doing on the field,
yeah.
But as we're learning from our day, it's also a lot from what you're doing off the field and you know, digging those roots into the community and attracting people to come and follow the club. You've been a big part in that sales pitch, if you like, creating that theme, creating this identity of this place in the last few years. How much do you enjoy seeing this place? Well,
it's easy to sell something when it's true. You know, I don't have to put it on, do I? I am here for those reasons, because I'm a local lad, played for the club and all. Michelle, like she said, is round the corner, Si's from Withenshaw, Jed's from Eccles. So, you know, it's very easy for us to beat the northern drum. But you can see it in terms of the recruitment and the retention of the lads coming through. You know, we've probably lost quite a few back in the day, looking for stars who were experienced and established from abroad or from elsewhere, whereas now we've had our two biggest years by way of academy recruitment. And a lot of our strategy, at a recruitment meeting on Tuesday, was just about retention, how we keep them on board, all these boys.
How challenging is it, that retention thing, with particularly young England guys? You've seen it with lots of clubs. Exeter have gone through it, where you get them all to a sort of international standard, maybe even a Lions standard, and then you can't afford to have all of them. And you're maybe at the start of that journey with some of these guys who you hope will get into the England team. Leicester might have it in a couple of years with their young lads, have all gotten to that setup.
Like,
how do you manage that, especially with a small salary cap? No, you can't have everyone on top dollar, can you? And you want some stardust there as well. That's a hell of a challenge for a director of rugby.
Yeah, no, it's the biggest challenge, working out the jigsaw succession planning kind of 3 or 4 years in advance. And then, you know, having your squad, and then, like you say, one or two of the lads just might see fit that they want to move for a change of environment, for a different experience, or, you know, maybe for family reasons. So the challenge is we have a lot of recruitment meetings, like bi-monthly, because things do shift and change that quickly, being really transparent across the organisation, again, with the lads. So if we feel like they're going to move on or require a lot more money, like, we know in advance where it's going, so that the final conversation is never a shock. And then you're constantly planning, reshifting and planning. Sometimes things don't shift a lot, but most of the time they do. Understanding where they are in the market value, and them understanding that we're probably not going to pay market value rate. We say that to them all. Like, you can always get more money somewhere else. Do you think you're going to get looked after as well here? Are you going to play for a club with your mates where you enjoy coming in every day, and, you know, a wider, higher purpose motivationally? Like, are you playing for a region where you got brought up and you were born and raised, and that has gone out of the game, well, until recent times here, I guess. You know, the playing for the North used to be something that was you aspired to do as a boy.
Can I ask you about two guys at sort of opposite ends of the spectrum? One who's a very exciting young player, Asher, a Poku Ford Jordan, who's been playing seriously well. Should we start with him?
Yeah, go for it.
What, three or four, five games and already making headlines in Newton, like everyone's loving what he's up to. How much is he someone that you have known about for a long time and gone, he's going to be coming? Or has he kind of shocked you and come early? Because he moved from Wasps, didn't he?
Yeah, he's one of the ones that have strengthened the squad along with the other, you know, 50 to 100 players who have strengthened the Premiership. And I think you can see the strengthening of these squads and the effect that that's had in Europe. Mm. They are stronger squad. Liam Cullen from Leinster mentioned that last week to me. They can see it, you know. So we were very lucky to pick Asher up. And he wasn't highly rated through the England schoolboys set-up at the time. A tight head, and they want him to play loose head. And so we're like, but, you know, these tight heads are rare anyway, and we want to give this lad a chance, as I've said, because we're looking to invest in academy. Got him into a scrum session, and I'm just watching him go against Si Mark. I'm like, jeez, like, how is he holding out there? Like, seeing him do things that 18-year-olds don't do. And then the feedback from the lads was like, this guy is strong, Al. Like, can't dig him out, you know, that right-hand side. But doesn't look a lot to him. He's going to put
quite short, isn't he?
He's quite short. He's quite narrow in his shoulders. He's quite heavily muscled and not a lot of fat on him. You know, normal tight heads are like barn doors. So if they lose the hit, they can just win it through weight. Now, he hasn't got the weight, but there must be something like a super strength around his core, because if he loses the hit, he can still sit in there and dig it out. Once he starts to get a bit of weight on and win the hit, then you're going to start seeing special things in terms of him going forward and winning penalties, and that's not far off.
You mentioned that England have seen him as a loose head. They still see him as a loose head. How do you manage that? Because it's an area of such specialty. How do you manage that, his development, in conjunction with England, where at the moment you see him on a different side of the front row?
He's still young. You know, it'll go back to 20s, hopefully, in a couple of weeks' time, so we can prep for the Six Nations. We want to give him that opportunity, if we can. We don't want to pigeonhole on either side at this moment in time. There's no prop that's able to play both sides effectively, you know, and switch quickly. He might be the exception moving forward, you never know. So I talked to Andy Titchell, who's the 20s coach, and he comes up and sees us. I played with him here, so we've got a good relationship there. We'll, again, keep the communication really transparent. Tom Harrison came up, the England forwards coach, had a look at him. And I just think, like, they get to see him maybe a couple of times a year and spend a few camps with him. We get to see him every day. Like, our understanding, and we win the most penalties at the moment in the Premiership by way of scrum. So by rights, ours is, should be, you know, the standard bearing opinion when it comes to scrum. Not that they don't have one, we'll take it on board. But moving forward, tight heads are harder to find than loose heads, good ones. So if you can make someone who's that dynamic into a tight head, it just makes sense to me. Like I've said before, he'd be an exceptional tight head, very good loose head. Because of his dynamism and mobility, like, different level tight head, and hopefully they'll come round to sense at some point.
At the other end of the spectrum, you've got Manu Tuilagi, 32. Yeah. He said himself he wasn't going to do a World Cup after 2019. He obviously did. How important has he been to the whole project as well? I mean, he's not a Northern lad like George Ford is coming back or something. But
honorary.
He's an honorary. He's calling everyone our kid and all that.
Yeah, he's bought into it, hasn't he?
Yes. He probably could have made a good tight head back in the day.
Yeah. he's nearly up to 4 years now, up at Sale, 2020.
Yeah, I've not been counting. Certainly all my time that's been here, and he was injured during the start of it. I've got always had a bit of a man crush on Manu, because when I grow up, I want to be more like him.
Physical.
Well, no, dominant. You've seen him. He's just so chilled out, isn't he? He's just so relaxed, so kind of worldly wise. Always smiling. I can't say the same for myself. You know, he's always super positive. Even when he's banging people, that's when he smiles the most. Like, there's nothing scarier, is there, than a smiling Manu Tuilagi. And he brings like a positive, excited energy rather than a nervous energy to the group when he plays and on the training field. So despite what he does, ball in hand, his ability just to dominate the gain line. Like, there's an extra string to his bow, I'd say, in terms of the effect he has on the people around him. And you probably felt that when you were sat next to him. There's an expression, it's not an expression actually, a neuroscientist who works for the Special Forces says that the skin is not the outside of you. They know this now, right? You're watching a film, you co-regulate your respiratory system to the person sat next to you without even knowing it. Without
Sync any kind up.
Of, yeah, you do. Yeah, you know, yeah. Like women and menstrual cycles, it's been proven. So if there's such a thing as positive energy, and it is contagious, and it's been proven to be so, Manu's the person that comes out of more than anyone else.
You've played with and worked with a lot of big players who have big influences on teams. Were you even aware of the idea of this energy that you just described as being a factor? You'd have seen an Owen Farrell in a squad environment, just
I've seen it in a different way. It's similar. Yeah, you can.
But were you
team.
Aware of the concept of it? Is that just something you learned more recently?
Or? Yeah, no, I think like the science is now catching up to coaches' field. Like everyone knows and understands that an environment and the sum of the parts and all that has relevance. You know, the closer the team, the tighter the team, the better connections. Now science just has just proven it to be the case. Like, increases oxytocin, which means you can run further, run for longer, and that is farmed through a sense of family and a higher purpose, really. So I've always been aware of it. It's always been the thing that's driven me as a coach. Like I say, now we can just prove it to be true.
And is it something on the recruitment subject? Less retention because you know them, but how do you judge it in recruitment?
Yeah. So we go through the due process that everyone goes through. So we'll watch the games and I'll spread the clips out through the coaches and we have a little chat about, is he the right fit for us with that, you know, in relation to our game model? So he has to pass the mustard in terms of talent, and then the interview process starts, really, in terms of when we meet him, how often we meet him, meeting his family, speaking to his dad, speaking to his girlfriend, understanding who he is as a person, kind of what's his story, because the what he does, he's already, normal people ring up and they say, well, what can you bring? What do you like about our game? Like, it's all BS, that, really. Once you're to that stage, it's like, how are you going to fit in? What's your support network? What are you interested in? Are you interested in something? And going down the roots of whether the character will add to the environment and not take away.
You went up mountain walking with Manu, didn't you, when you first
started? I won't call shuttling slow a mountain, but...
hill, fell walking.
Yeah, fell walking. And we did take him up Snowdon, but he had his Achilles then, so we took all the lads up Snowdon. We have been mountain walking twice. We went on the roller coaster down in Devon with the forces this summer. So we try and get out in the wilderness when we can. It breaks down barriers, doesn't it? And not just the fatigue element, but when you're walking next to someone, there's no confrontation there, and I find it's a good way to communicate, you know, effectively.
So you're taking him up another hill for a big chat then?
No, we said we'll just, like, I know he says I drank his wine, and I did drink his bottle of wine, so I still owe him one. We are at such a level now that we can just sit across, eat a steak and have a glass of wine, and I think be as honest as we need to be.
Awesome.
Alex, thank you very much, and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Rest of the season 2024. Thanks for having us.
Cheers, boys. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, as Alex Sanderson was walking away there, he said, oh, the Chuckle Brothers are up next. So Tom Roebuck, Joe Carpenter. Is that harsh? Is that a genuine nickname? Or where's that come from?
I've not heard him call us that before, to be fair.
No, that's harsh. That's harsh.
Is that
I
harsh?
Mean, we get on quite well, but I don't know whether we're quite to me to you in terms of the Chuckle Brothers.
Hopefully got a bit more up there than he likes to think.
Yeah, but. Okay. Do you guys live together?
We do, yeah.
You
do,
so
we
you,
live in Manchester, yeah.
Flatmates?
Correct.
So flatmates, train together. Are you ever apart?
We were when we were younger.
Yeah,
we were. Now,
not so much, nah. The only time is probably when he's in his room playing Xbox or something like that, and I'm in the kitchen.
So you do the cooking, do you?
It tends to fall upon me.
Well, he used to be a good lad and jump on Warzone with the boys, but now he's just sits on his phone and watches movies and does all the housework, basically, which is perfect for me.
See, now this is where the podcast could suddenly go down a rabbit hole we didn't expect. Cause you're talking my language now if you're talking about Warzone. We could get into that massively.
Right, we can sack the rugby off if you want.
I'm like, Tom, what are you doing? Come on, you need
sorry,
to...
Sorry,
you need
I'll
to
get back on it,
Sean. Yeah. We've been chatting to loads of different people at the club today, and there's a number of different kind of themes and things we've spoken about, but part of that has been being the pride of the North and having young Northern lads coming through. Like, what's it like for you guys at the start of your careers coming into this team and being a part of that and that kind of project?
I think for me, I came over from Leeds, but you know, it's an hour away. It's not too far. It's not going down south. It's not that different kind of culture in that environment. So I think I slotted in quite well. And look, we've got a great diverse squad of you know, a lot of South Africans, but then also, like you say, a lot of lads now coming through that are from Manchester, from around here, that grew up loving the club, grew up wanting to play for the club and now do. So I think that passion and that love for the club definitely helps out there when we're playing on the weekend and when we're training.
Yeah, I also just add that I think, like, with this whole mantra that we've sort of brought in of Northern Rugby Matters, it's probably something that we've bought into as well, especially as us young lads that are Northern. I think that it just means a bit more to us being from this area and playing for a club that, like we say, we've grown up and we've wanted to play for and we've supported before we did enter this environment. So just that extra push or drive to sort of bring on this team to do what we can do is massive for us, yeah.
You talked to us about the environment that Alex Anderson creates here. He's been such a driver of that theme, and one of the themes of his coaching career has always been to create narratives and things that people can grab onto.
Yeah.
What's he like to work for? How I presume it's really easy to buy into his vision, but to give us an idea of some of the narratives and some of the things he creates for you to really grab hold of.
Yeah, he loves a story, and he loves a sort of a theme of the week, if you will, every week, sort of a new sort of thing that we're going after that relates to the team we're playing and stuff like that. So it's good in that sense, because it means you can, like, relate to it in that way, and you can sort of buy into something, and everyone will go after the same sort of thing instead of people interpret it in the different ways, if you will. And, like, just the environment he creates is one of joy, one of excitement, and one of sort of drive as well. Like, he'll push you to be the best you can be, but it'll also be in a way that you enjoy and in a way that you want to do best for the club and for your teammates.
I think for me it's just kind of making every week important is something that he does real well. You know, it'd be quite easy to, especially this middle patch of the season, to get into just the ebbs and flows of, you know, oh, another game, or we're reviewing a game, we're doing this, whereas that little extra bit of detail, that little extra effort from the coaching staff is massive in terms of making every week fresh, every week new. It's something different and it's something else to go after, instead of just, you know, it's another game on the weekend. It's that little bit something more, I think.
Without revealing anything too deep into the team, is there a theme from some point in recent matches this season or last season that really resonated, that sticks with you now?
I think for me there was one against Bath. It was the Battle of the Bands. It was just a theme around kind of their X factor, their superstars, and how we can nullify that and end up bringing the best out of ourselves and bringing our noise, especially at home and stuff, was something that was quite good this year. And look, we got the performance that weekend as well, which is great.
Battle of the Bands.
I think we had one a few years ago as well, actually. It was when we played Bristol. It was about a circus and circus bears performing, and that Bristol, as they were back then, being that team that would just play from anywhere, like, really exciting sort of team, just throw it around, and we sort of just had the theme of cage the bear, sort of stop their circus rolling and just sort of poke it, if you will, and get it to get a bit angry, and then we can go after them in that way.
I can't remember if either of you were playing, but I think I remember there was one around the Scarlets, beat them away 50-odd in Europe, and that was Slay the Dragon, wasn't it, that
yeah.
time?
I think we were there. I didn't play it.
Did you not play that one?
No,
I didn't play that one either.
I think we were a bit finished.
That was a great performance. Classic. As well, actually.
Can I ask both of you, you've had a couple of seasons now in the main side and made it to the final. What's motivating you both to keep coming again? Because that Alex talked about it with us. It must be difficult when you're building all the way to the final and then you think this could be our moment and it doesn't quite happen. So where have you come to now that you're in the middle of the new season of what you're trying to get better at and how you're motivating yourselves to do it again?
Firstly, for us, it's probably that feeling that we felt at the final. Like, it was one of the best games I've ever been involved in, despite the loss. And the emotion and the excitement leading up to that moment was something I want to feel again, but I've not felt before. And that's a big driver for us. And then for me, and I'm imagining for you as well, it's that sort of drive to be the best you can be and sort of go on and do bigger things. Like, we play at Sale and we want to be the best we can be for Sale, but we also want to be the best players we can be. And if that's international rugby, that's what we're going after.
Is that the same for you, Joe?
I'd say so. I mean, for me, it was my first season in the Premiership. And it was kind of that fairy tale story of winning it in that first year for me. And like Tom said, that feeling of that game and that feeling that, you know, as a squad, we were good enough to win, and we didn't on the day. And it just, I think, a lot of the boys that played last year, a lot of the boys in the squad this year, just like Tom said, just know we can do it deep down, and we want to do it. And, you know, Sale haven't done it for many years now, and it's something that we definitely want to go after and we think we can do. And when you've got that belief within the squad, you've got that belief within the coaching staff that, you can go out and do it, then it's just, you know, building through the season, make sure you get to that point again so you can get it right.
Was that your first time you played at Twickenham, both of you?
It was for me. I think you...
I played there for school before once. Okay. But it was obviously miles different how the final was.
Maybe for you, Joe, if that was your first, is there that motivation too, you would both like to play Test rugby, to go back there and say, like, I would love in 2 years to come to get that England shirt as well as the Sale one?
Yeah, 100%. Like, it's, you know, it's always a dream to play that international rugby and, you know, to have that opportunity to play there last year, get used to, obviously, it wasn't packed out, but I think there was about 65,000 there. You know, getting used to that atmosphere, getting used to that many people being at a game, playing in front of that many people is, you know, definitely a great thing to have happened. Whether we can do that again this year before we play international rugby, or whether international rugby comes quicker, is, you know, no one can predict that, but it's definitely something that we both loved on the day, and definitely want to do again.
You're not dual qualified like Tom, though, are you? So you don't have as many options.
Unfortunately not. No, I'm an English thoroughbred, so that's my only route. So hopefully one day we can get there.
Have you had any contact either way, Tom, for either Scotland or England? Do you have to make a decision yet or not?
Fighting, aren't they?
No, there's no.
Are they fighting?
They're not fighting.
They're
not fighting, no. There's obviously been conversations regarding both sides, and I think it's more with the team around here, like my coaches around here, that I just want to be sure that if I was to get selected, like, I've not been selected for anything yet. It's just a case of I need to get selected for something first, and then that's when a decision is probably going to have to be made. And for me, it's just about making the right one and what feels right for me.
If I'm right, you were both part of a group who met Steve Borthwick recently. Can you give us a flavour of the conversation? Was it just getting to know him? Was he out sort of laying out his vision for the next era for England, Six Nations and beyond? What was the sort of the nature of your chat?
It was sort of, for us, more than the other lads that were there, getting to know someone, really. Like, he needs to get to know us and we need to get to know him, which was the premise of our conversations, I believe. And he obviously had a meeting with everyone about the England way, so to speak, and how England want to play. But for the individual chats that we had, it was more just about getting to know each other.
Lads, awesome. We really appreciate you joining us. All the best for the year ahead. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So there you have it. Back to back to back. I said it during the episode. It was quite literally a revolving door of guests we had up here on this stage. But awesome.
Can't ask for better than that. Two current England players, head coach, co-owner, two young lads on the rise. Happy days.
Yeah, I was trying to remember as we sat here. I think the first Premiership game I ever covered was Sale Sharks at Hayward Road. Would have been about 2001, maybe. They were building up towards winning the league.
Five years later, they had
some star players coming through. I remember Clive Woodward was in the stand, sitting just in front of us. And then, as Michelle said, they hit the heights, then they had a dip, and now they're back again as a team with England stars, with international stars, and with rising stars.
And a women's programme as well.
And a women's programme, and it just feels like a cool place. You know, I guess what Alex is trying to create is, I think, as he said, they're not going to pay as much as some places, but he's trying to create an environment that you want to be part of. And if you were a young player with a choice, you'd want to be part of something here. You can feel it. And if you're from the region, he's really tapping into that. So, yeah, it's been a cool day here, and it's nice to see a club like Sale, you know, coming back and re-establishing themselves again in the Prem.
And I hope that we can do this at other clubs too.
Yes.
So this is a plan, isn't it? If people are listening to this and say, oh, you should be coming around to our club, then get in touch.
Yeah, we are going to hope to try and get around all the different clubs in the Premiership over time, but that's a task for the new year,
New Year's resolution, there you go.
New Year's resolution. The next episode as well will also be our end of 2023 look ahead to 2024 end of season awards episode. So that'll be coming out on New Year's Day. And just a final thank you to Sale Sharks for hosting us as well. It's been an awesome day up here. Love chatting to everyone that has been on the podcast. So really appreciate that from them. But enjoy the rest of your festive period, and we'll see you in 2024.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.,
Oh no!
So how would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air. The podcast now available on the Times Radio app.